Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Hi, this is Bill, and welcome to this week's episode of Real World Fitness. So glad you took the time to join us. Got an amazing guest this week. I know I say that all the time, but I really, really do. This woman is very possibly Canada's greatest female athlete. Not greatest blind athlete or disabled athlete, but overall, quite possibly Canada's most decorated, most honored, most successful female athlete. That says a lot, doesn't it? She is a multiple Paralympic champion. She has over 19 medals to her credit in international competitions. And when she stopped competing as an athlete, she started representing the other athletes, serving on both the International Paralympic Committee and the International Olympic Committee. And she's just a really cool lady. Her name is Lilo. I'm not going to attempt the last name because I don't want to look foolish. And more importantly, I don't want her to correct me again. And we'll have my conversation, because it really was more of a conversation with Lilo, in just a few minutes. Before we get to that, I want to thank those of you that sent me in some nice comments this past week. And I realized from a couple statements and emails that I didn't make one thing very clear in my discussion of setting and achieving goals. There is a reason to set goals. If you don't, your training will just flounder. It's important to set goals. I received comments from people who said, I don't really have any goals. I just work out because I enjoy doing it. Well, that's fine. But if you want to see the optimum results, you need to create little goals. They don't have to be big monumental goals. You just have to have little battles, little things to achieve on a regular basis to keep you focused and keep you motivated. You know, it's like getting in your car and deciding you're going to go for a drive. You may end up someplace great by accident, but you'll drive around and you'll waste a lot of gas and waste a lot of time. And if you got in the car and went, let's go to the store, you'd get there much quicker. So that's the only thing I wanted to add to all of what I had to say about goal setting and achieving goals last week. Even if you really don't have huge aspirations, using little goals in your training help you keep focused, help you get motivated, help you keep motivated. Now, our main sponsor, audiblepodcast.com/Serotalk. I got lost in time on their site again. I love wandering around on this website. Not only do they have thousands of awesome books by all of my favorite authors, but they have tons of old radio programs. I saw this morning, in looking on there, a radio broadcast of one of my all-time favorite movies, The Maltese Falcon. Wow, I never heard of this before. That's very cool. And just in looking through other old radio shows, I used to like Dragnet, you know, just the facts, ma'am. And there's a 120-plus hour Dragnet radio program on there. You know, it's I don't know how many episodes, but it's 120-plus hours. And you can get that for free just by going to audiblepodcast.com/Serotalk and signing up for a free one-month trial. There's so much stuff on this site. I didn't have a clue when I first looked at it. I went, okay, well, what's the big deal? Some audiobooks. And then I started looking around and went, wow. Even to the point that there are certain books that are on there many, many times, narrated by different people. So if you have a preference, you go, wow, okay, there's three different versions of this book narrated by three different people. I like this guy's voice better. Okay, let's go with that one. It's just some really cool stuff. I wouldn't spend all this time talking about the site just because they're our sponsor if I really didn't think it was a cool thing. Now, I've been really working hard on coming up with some excellent guests for you guys. I would like to hear some input from people out there as to what you'd like to hear about, what you'd like to maybe have me focus about for a show or a specific guest. But now I know I have some wrestling fans out there, and I just want to clue you in. I have been in contact with the WWE trying to get permission to interview some of the really, really big stars of the past. I know most of my listeners are a little older, so you guys are probably fans of the product from the 70s and 80s and 90s. And made contact with a couple guys that I knew who used to be in the industry. And I was told, well, you know, I'm still under a what they call a legends contract with WWE. So you have to get permission for me to do an interview. And I've been in contact with their talent department, and looks like I'm going to have, I'm not going to say who, but if you're a wrestling fan, and I know there's a few out there, keep your ears tuned to the show, because we will have one for sure of the most extraordinarily physically fit and athletic wrestlers of all time doing an interview in the near future. And another fellow that I've met over the years a few times that I'm trying to catch up with, he's got a really busy schedule, and we're trying to figure out if we can actually find an hour to sit down and talk. So that's on the horizon. And as I mentioned a few weeks ago, coming up on the May 21st or 22nd broadcast, whenever we release it, Thursday or Friday, my birthday show, I will have one of my personal bodybuilding heroes, a gentleman who is legendary. And that's a word they throw around real easily these days in a lot of sports and a lot of industries. But this gentleman had a undefeated run in the sport, running for 20 years, won every major title except the Mr. Olympia. And he never won that because he chose to never compete in it. And well, I'll tell you now, his name is Bill Pearl. He won the 1953 Mr. America, Mr. Universe, 56 Mr. USA, 61 Mr. Universe, 67 Mr. Universe. And at age 41, he decided to come back one last time in 1971, and he annihilated all of the top guys in the industry at that time, winning his last Mr. Universe. And he was kind enough to grant me an interview a few months ago, and he hasn't done an interview with anyone for over 10 years, so I was really excited about that. And we'll have that for you on the May 21st broadcast. And now, let's get to that conversation with my new Canadian friend, Miss Lilo. And now, ladies and gentlemen, my guest, the lady whose last name I could not pronounce correctly if you held a gun to my head, Lilo. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Just for everybody's edification, say your name correctly once for me.
Okay, it's Liliana Ljubicic.
Oh, dear God.
That's why most people just call me Lilo.
Okay, well, I'm going to stick with Lilo. I hate to be most people, but in this case, I have no choice. Limited abilities. You have an absolutely amazing athletic background, and from what I understand, you come from a family of athletes, so it comes to you naturally. And let's just start back. I mean, obviously, all these Paralympics and all these awards and everything had to start somewhere. Let's talk about your athletic background and your growing up and your family and all the physicality of it.
Well, I come from very athletic parents, and I guess they gave me great genes. My dad was great in basketball and soccer and anything to do with the ball. My mom was a rower, And a lot of that, I guess, physical attributes and talent came to myself and my brother. I always had a burn in the gut and a boil in the blood to be athletic and active. And I was always very competitive, but not in a sense of wanting to take somebody out. It's just wanting to be the best that I could be. My earliest memories were of watching the Olympics. And literally every 4 years, because back then they were only held every 4 years, the summer and the winter, only with about 5-6 months apart. My dad and I would be watching the winter or the summer Olympics, and sometimes we would actually get fevers from cheering certain teams on or just never peeling ourselves away from the television screen long enough to catch a breath or have some water or have a meal. And I always admired those incredible athletes and specimens of athletic prowess on the screen, albeit I was losing my sight at that time and I was visually impaired, but I could still see well enough if I sat very close to the front of the television. And I admired all that incredible physical ability. And somewhere deep down inside, I knew that I wanted to be one of those people, except with one problem. I never saw anyone on that television screen that represented the kind of disability that I had, or any disability, in fact. I did not know that the Paralympics at that time existed. Certainly, they did not come into my life until I was just finishing high school and going into university.
Well, disabled people did not make good TV back then.
I believe that that is partly true. I think the other part of that is that I don't think anyone thought that we could make good TV, and therefore didn't put us in front of cameras, let alone on tracks and in pools.
That's exactly.
I was introduced, I was always very active, physically active, and used to have pretty darn good skills with a basketball and a volleyball and skiing and cycling and other activities, but nothing organized until I got into university. And I was talent identified by a gentleman who, a fellow Paralympian. He introduced me to something called goalball, which is basically team handball for the blind. Talked me into going to a trials, and I went, kind of kicking and screaming because I really had other things to do, like my academics, and fell in love, not with him, but with this sport, which literally propelled me into the world of Paralympics for the next 25 years.
Okay, I want to do a quick subject change. Because you're obviously, I've discovered in talking with you, you're a multifaceted person with a lot of gifts, not just your athletic prowess. But what kind of a student were you?
I was a pretty studious student. Blessed with something that I've lost since, which is a photographic memory, due to the fact that I can't see anymore to refresh it. I studied hard. I worked hard. I was in mainstream schools. I was never institutionalized. My parents fought that type of system, even in a communist country, to keep me out of it. So I was always in the public school system, very misunderstood, very challenged in an environment that did not understand me and that was not prepared for someone like myself. However, with their incredible support always behind me, I managed to finish high school, elementary school and high school, and went on to university. And just at that time when I was entering university, that's when the institutions, at least in Canada, were opening their doors and letting all their alumni out and allowing them to go into public school systems where supposedly there were special education teachers there to support them. But I had never had the benefit of that assistance.
Okay, so you said growing up in a communist country. I know you live in Canada now, and you've lived in Canada for a very long time, but where did you actually grow up?
I know some people tend to think that Canada is a very socialist country, and somehow that is like on swings to the pendulum of communism, but that's not what I was referring to. I was born in we right now call formerly the Yugoslavia, Republic of Yugoslavia. However, now I guess I have to categorize myself because there's no such country. I have to categorize myself as Serbian.
You can categorize yourself however you choose to. I don't think anyone's going to have the nerve to argue with you.
Well, I've been a Canadian for very many years. In fact, we moved to Canada when I was 8 and a half, nearly 9 years old. And I'm far more Canadian than anything else, but certainly a Canadian with a very strong and talented and proud ethnic background.
That's a wonderful thing. So goalball was your first competitive, really competitive sport. Before that, it was just things you enjoyed doing with your father, your brother, your friends. But as far as competition goes, goalball was the starting point.
Yeah, as far as competition, I mean, grade 11 PE, I started playing a little bit of volleyball and basketball with a very creative and wonderful teacher in physical ed who actually integrated me into the physical education class. And I began my discovery or journey to discovery in that way, but that wasn't competitive. It was simply in class. So goalball was my first attempt at true competitive sports for athletes with a disability. I went to my first games and came back with a medal and with my feet not touching the ground for about 6 months before and after the games. And there were individuals in my country that were sort of impressed with what my potential might still have hidden within it, and had me try out all kinds of different activities and sports. And certainly my blindness prohibited me from pursuing the kinds of sports that I really wanted to play. Beach volleyball would have been totally up my alley. Volleyball, basketball were my loves as well. And certainly those are sports that a blind person could not participate in. I didn't like cold water and early mornings, and therefore swimming was totally out. I tried various track and field events, didn't like running so much, but I was always very strong and powerful. I don't know what led me to that, but I ended up going into discus and shot put. I had already been doing weightlifting through my university, early university and late high school years, and that certainly helped me with goalball. And discus and shot put seemed to kind of be, just kind of dovetailed into my present abilities. Yeah, my forte at that time.
Let me ask you, because this was before there were such things as, well, whatever Canada's version of the ADA is and requirements for accessibility, you had a physical education teacher that obviously on her own got creative and tried to figure out how to make it work that you could participate. What kind of things were done to, because I see sometimes that people overdo the adaptations. They do them to the point that you don't even recognize what the sport is anymore. And you were in a situation where it was, well, we want this kid to participate in class. What can we do to make it work? What did she, I'm assuming she,
yeah,
do to make it work for you with the basketball and the volleyball?
Well, for me, it was pretty revolutionary. And she just changed the rules. She looked at... And it's quite revolutionary when you think about it. I mean, these are not the Olympics. Of course, you can change the rules. She kept me after school and we went through a number of physical tests and things like that. And she evaluated what I could and couldn't do. And for example, she decided that volleying the ball while playing volleyball was not going to work for someone that was extremely light sensitive, that could not look up and look at into the lights, and that had obviously pain in her eyes. But she realized that I had a body that could deliver a ball. And therefore, she made me the server. So she spent a few days after school teaching me how to serve a ball underhanded. And then unbeknownst to the class, when they picked teams and I was the last to get chosen, to their chagrin, she made an announcement that while we were going to all be playing volleyball nicely today, Lilo would have one responsibility, and that would be to serve the ball. And so she made everybody else rotate as per required, and I was the only one that actually served the ball on my team. And that was a pretty amazing experience. I was shaking in my sneakers, I'll tell you that much for sure. And everybody was staring at me, which was intimidating and not so unusual. And I took a deep breath at some point and said, all right, well, I've cut the ball and I've got to do this. And we actually ended up winning the first game. I think it was something like 14 to 15 or something crazy. I think half those points that we scored was simply from the shock that, you know, from the other team that couldn't believe that, Blindy was actually capable of doing something like that. In basketball, she changed the rules again. Every two or three passes, the ball had to be passed to me. Being that I was visually impaired, we decided that no one would chest pass. They would bounce the ball into the floor while calling my name. So they'd call out my name. I would focus on them. They would bounce the ball to me. Once I caught the ball, and you could try and get the ball away from me. Once I caught the ball, you could not take the ball away from me. And there was no traveling rule applied to me. Everybody else had to stick to the traveling rule. And I would dribble and try and move my way towards the correct basket. And certainly I would do a set shot and you could try and block me. You could not take the ball away from me, but you could try and block me. Once the ball was up in the air, it was fair game. And, and the rebounds and all that stuff were taken care of by other people, not by myself. And those are some of the ways that we change rules. Racquetball was one of my favorites.
And this was long before they had beepers to attach to the basketball hoop and all of that type of thing, right?
Absolutely. No. I was the only blind person in my life and my teacher's life and in my parents' life. And no one knew anything about beepers or adaptive sports or even the fact that people with disabilities or blind individuals could actually be active. She put me in a smaller gym and put me in there with another poor victim and gave us a racquetball and a couple of rackets and said, all right. And she watched us play and she realized that I couldn't retrieve the ball in time. So she allowed me to have two bounces and by which time I would have to, smash away at the ball and position myself. And the other person only had one bounce like every other side person. Love the racquetball because I could really take my aggression out and just pound away on that wall.
Do we have some anger issues?
No, I just loved hitting things like that. Like get me with a tennis ball and a racket. I mean, I don't promise to get the ball anywhere except maybe embedded in the links of the fencing, but all I wanted to do was just hit things hard.
You're just a very physical person.
Very much so, yeah.
That's great. We're going to get back to the Paralympics and all of that, but you mentioned your vision. I want to just briefly touch on the condition because that's something everybody out there listening always wants to know. And the reason you and I are talking today is kind of interesting. It stems from an email you sent me, and would you like to talk about that just a little bit and about your visual condition?
Yeah, I actually heard an interview on one of your podcasts, and there was a young woman who had something that rang a bell with me. It is a very rare condition and rarer still to survive it, and it's called Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And there are two types, and I had the worst kind, the TENS version. And I was 16 months of age when I was misdiagnosed with a childhood illness. The doctor thought I had something else instead of having maybe chickenpox and or measles. And he gave me a sulfa-based antibiotic, which is one of the number one culprits when it comes to Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And basically, in a nutshell, about 99% of the people that contract this condition die in the first 48 hours. And of the 1% that survive, only 10% of those have their eyes affected. And I fell into that small minority that had their eyes affected. And the way that happened is that basically the lining of the underside of my eyelids was genetically changed or physically changed, reprogrammed perhaps. And each one of those cells began to grow hair. And lest anyone should think that I had eyelashes that just simply curved inwards, that's not what I had. I had normal eyelashes. What I did not have is normal lining of the underside of my eyelids, which started to produce hair. And therefore, I basically had something akin to steel bristles as brushes underneath the eyelids that would scrape up and down and poke and tear away at my corneal tissue, and did that for 26 years.
So basically, all of you out there that know how annoying and painful it can be to, you know, get a grain of sand in your eye at the beach or something gets blown in your eye and it just annoys you. That's one little thing. Imagine it covering your entire eyelid of both eyes and being there all the time. Now I see why you wanted to hit things.
Yeah, well, the pain was ever present, ever existing, never ceasing. It was there 24/7, 7 days a week. At night, it was horrible because the restful time of sleep that you need, that's called REM sleep, which is rapid eye movement, that's really not what my body needed the rest, but it did not need the rapid eye movement. Closing my eyes, you could not escape the pain because even with my eyes closed, the bristles were still sticking in my cornea. Every movement that my eye made underneath the eyelids or the eyelids themselves just simply added thousands more new scrapes and scratches on top of the ones below, which lay on top of the ones below that were recently placed above the ones below. There was never any time to heal. And these scrapes and scratches and scars and tears simply abrased the cornea, inflamed it, infected it, caused ulcers to grow on it, had those ulcers infected with bristles inside of it, with infections on top of it. There were times that my life was not worth living, quite honestly. The pain was one thing, but if any one of your listeners had ever had an eyelash or a piece of dust fall into their eye and actually scrape at the tiniest bit of a scrape of a cornea, one, it's excruciatingly painful and uncomfortable, but secondly, it causes extreme light sensitivity. And so on top of the pain that I had and the gradual loss of sight, even though I still had a tremendous amount of sight, I was limited by the sheer existence of light. I was literally blinded by the light. And through all that light and through all that pain, I was still a little girl that had a little brother that wanted to play games, that wanted to ride a bicycle, that wanted to ride roller skates, that wanted to play volleyball in high school, that wanted to appear like a normal other little teenager that didn't have to wear dark glasses and baseball caps and shield her face with her eyes or duck her head and always look like she was shy or ducking or embarrassed.
So you say you had this until you were 26. Was there finally a point that these hair follicles were surgically removed, or what caused the change that you no longer have this horrible condition that's bothering you all the time?
I had the blessing of meeting or discovering the existence of Dr. Richard Anderson from Salt Lake City, who invented the technique of removing this type of hair growth. Back then, it was done by a cryogenic technique where it was a very delicate surgery that required freezing of tissue and the separation of very delicate tissues and sewing them back and all that other stuff. Today, much of that can be done with lasers, although I'm not sure that the number of hairs that I had and the density of the growth, that could be done by laser, and perhaps still it might have to be done partially by cryogenics.
So that was the turning point when that pain finally left. That must have been one of the most wonderful experiences of your life.
Oh my God, that was like one of the most insane and liberating experiences. And yet it was also awe-inspiring from the point of view that it took about 3 to 4 months for me to recover from all the heavy medications and prednisones and the swelling and all kinds of stuff that was going on that was required to happen in order for me to recover. And once I recovered, the first thing that I could do was just like awesome. I could actually get rid of my sunglasses. I'd been wearing sunglasses since the time I was 18 months of age. And here, for the first time, I was no longer captive or forced to hide behind glasses, sunglasses, because of that horrible light. And oh, just opening up my eyes, I actually had to learn that I could open my eyes, I could lift my eyelids, and the pain that I anticipated and the tenseness that I would feel in my nerves and my muscles and my face and my neck and my head slowly began to relax, realizing that the anticipated pain just did not arrive. And yet I still walked around for about a month with something like akin to like the, you know, when you have something at the tip of your tongue and it just won't come to you, but it's right there and the word won't come. Well, that's something what I had, but it was on my brain. My brain was struggling with something to it. It was trying to identify something. It was trying to reach out and put a name on something that I was not even aware of its struggles, except that little hesitant moment that was constantly there, until one day it came out of my brain like a bolt of lightning. And it was my brain going, I got it. I absolutely got it. That's it. That's got to be it. And it was literally naming the state of painlessness. It's actually it reached back to beyond the time when I was 17 and 16 and 15 and 14 months of age, at the time when I was still healthy and no hair in my eyes. And it tried to remember a time when I had lived without that never, ever ceasing pain. And finally, after a month, it identified it.
You're very fortunate that it only took a month, because you've lived with it for so many years. Your body had built up those protective mechanisms. Don't do this, it's going to hurt. Don't do that, it's going to hurt. You know it's going to hurt, so you expect the pain. And even after, intelligently and logically, you knew it's not going to hurt anymore, your body's going, yeah, it is. It always does.
Oh, yeah. The conditioned response was there.
Exactly.
I guess.
Self-preservation.
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is. But you know, we are so blessed with the most incredible organ in our body, and that is the brain. And it is so adaptable, and we are created to adapt. And it is so adaptable, it was able to adjust to every minute little change. And you know what? Years down the road, I get an eyelash or a normal piece of dust in my eye, and I'm like, what the heck is this pain? Why is it that I can't manage it? I used to manage 1,000 degrees more pain, and now I get ticked off when I get a single eyelash in my eye and I'm like pulling my hair out. And that's
the
other thing.
You've gotten soft.
I've gotten soft, but you know what? It's a wonderful softness. Because the brain has actually managed to put away and forget about that horrible nightmare of pain that it had to live through and make me survive through 26 years. But it's amazing how quickly we forget the pain, and we even throw away those survival skills when we no longer have to keep them constantly on guard.
That's amazing. So let's get back to the athletics, because this is depressing. It's horrible to listen to, and I feel so sorry for you, but I don't, because I know you, and I know you're this amazing woman with an amazing life. I just know you went through hell for the first part of it. Let's go back to the athletics. Knowing your personality from the little bit of conversation that we've had, I am guessing that you were happier in an individual sport than you were as part of a team. Would I be correct in that? The track and field events, the shot put and so on. I think that just suits your personality more than being part of a team.
Partly. I think it was also because I was young and didn't know how to play politics. And I really detested the idea that politics and sports could actually come into play. I prefer to be on a team where people are working as hard as they possibly can, using their talents to their best and utmost ability and pulling their weight. And if everybody's doing that, I'm okay with whatever result comes in the end. But when I came to the realization that I wanted to take full responsibility for my sports, I moved into discus and shot put, where I knew that, you know, should I fail today? Well, my ego was bare naked out there and I had to deal with that. And when I won and when I was successful, it was also a success that I could easily and happily share with someone else, which normally would be my coach. But I tend to take my own responsibility, and that way I knew where, if there was a loose end, I knew who was responsible for leaving it loose.
Mm-hmm. So the first Paralympics was as part of a goalball team, and then all the subsequent ones were in the shot and discus?
Correct. And it's not Paralympics, it's Paralympics.
Paralympics.
That's right.
Sorry.
Paralympics.
About that.
That's all right. Basically, discus and shot put became my life for the next 20 years, 25 years, actually.
Those are very interesting, unusual sport choices for a woman. And I want to address this here now because we're going to talk about your training and your nutrition a little bit. But when you talk about a female shot putter or discus, I just have this, most people have this image of a linebacker, large, massive, muscular woman. And you're not that at all.
Nope. I went a long way to kind of modify my body for my athletic goals. However, I am 6'2" and currently about 163, 64 pounds. I did force myself to get to about 187, 190 pounds, but that was simply by choice. But I never looked like one of those fridges. I've been called many things, but a fridge, never. Malibu Barbie, Wonder Woman, something like that.
Yeah, that's nice. That's very nice.
I love having a strong body. I love having defined muscles, small waist and small hips, and defined arms and defined shoulders and a strong back. And I knew that I could deliver a discus or a shot put from this body and still look good in a miniskirt at the party when I was celebrating the gold.
Okay. Well, see, that's a very important thing that I want my female listeners to understand. A lot of women are under that misconception of, you know, lifting weights, I'm going to get masculine looking. I'm going to get too muscular. I'm not going to look feminine. A little muscle on a woman's body is very attractive. And this woman was a world-class athlete. And if she's still walking around in a miniskirt getting lots of attention, obviously she's not too muscular.
No, I looked toned, defined. You certainly couldn't see fat on me. I had a 6-pack or a 12-pack. Certainly.
Let's leave your drinking habits out of this.
But the thing is that, you know what? I love the fact that I had the ability to feel power in my body, within myself. If I needed to pick up a suitcase, if I needed to pick up a grocery bag, if I needed to beat up a mugger in the streets of Madrid, I knew I could do it. But at the same time, I never had any lack of dance partners on my dance card, nor interest from in that type of arena. So I'm a very feminine looking woman, but I also knew how to use the power that I gained through weightlifting and training and my sports. But my sports, as you mentioned very clearly, discus and shot put, are meant for power events and for strength. And you have to be strong and you have to be powerful. And the only way you can do that is by lifting weights. And it's by lifting heavy weights, not little weights. And that misnomer that women are going to look like Mr. Atlas or Ms. Atlas simply don't understand that the female body, not even the male body, is made for that without a lot of chemical assistance, which is illegal to do. And I would never have done it in any case. But women need a lot of chemical assistance, plastic surgery, because when you see those women that have those great big huge knockers, but they are as muscular as my brother, those are all fake things. That they have to work so hard and so long and so much. It's ridiculous that no one, you going to the gym and getting in shape and getting fit for life and getting fit for health and getting fit for to be strong is ever going to look like that unless they have gone to some big time extremes.
It doesn't happen by accident.
Absolutely not.
You have to work very, very hard.
And popping a few pills and taking a few injections along the way.
This is also part of it at times, yeah. But so all of you out there that are afraid of lifting because you're afraid you're going to get too muscular, it's not going to happen. The genetic predisposition for that to happen is so rare, it's virtually, it's not there. Your hormones are not going to allow it to happen.
Even men who are those big muscular kind of guys, and they're also doing they're popping a lot of pills, and they're called steroids and growth hormones and anabolics. And that's what the Olympic and the Paralympic world test all their athletes for, and a million other drugs and medications. But the fact remains also that lifting small weights won't make any change in your body either. And if you're seeking to find that sense of power and to get that definition and to feel strong and get healthy and get active and feel sexy and feel powerful, you're not going to do it with the 8-pound dumbbell in your hand either. I hate to break it to you, Bill.
Thank you so much. I've been saying this all along, but now we have a woman saying it, and a very, very physically attractive woman. So that just proves the point that much stronger. And yeah, I know, guys, I can't see, but after I looked at her website, I asked my wife to look at the pictures, and she said, oh, wow, tall, bigger girl, really hot, nice body. She looked like a guy? No, she looks like a woman. And that's coming from another woman, so...
Well, to this day, I train 5 days a week, even though I am retired from competitive sports. And a lot of people ask me, oh, are you still competing? And no. Well, why are you going to the gym? It's because I'm committed to staying healthy, staying fit, looking younger way beyond my years, and staying active, feeling alive. And it's really important to me. That is really important to me. And to this very day, even though I'm not competing or throwing around discuses or shot puts, I still curl 40-pound dumbbells. I still squat 250 pounds on occasion. I still bench press over 150 pounds. You know, it's because I like to do that, but it's not because I like to look like a man.
And the real reason she goes to the gym still is the same reason I do and everyone else I know that's done it for 20 or 30 years. We're addicted.
Yeah.
We can't stop.
Oh, it's the best addiction you could possibly have. The high that you get after a workout is amazing. And a lot of people don't understand that. It's like I'm sure many people have heard about the runner's, what is it? The runner's second wind or
runner's
the
high.
Runner's high. You get that from weightlifting and with far less pain, as far as I'm concerned. I hate running. And like I could not wait to hit that runner's high. Whereas with my weightlifting, after about 45 minutes of weightlifting and about an hour on my bike, I am feeling fantastic. I am ready to take on the world. And you know what? even if I don't achieve anything for the rest of the day, I have achieved one super important thing. I have pumped up my endorphins. I feel awesome. I feel healthy. I feel alive. I feel awake and I feel pumped. And I feel ready to take on anything I need to take for the rest of the day.
I always train early in the morning, and I've found that the days that I don't lift, I don't fully wake up, I'm not as energized, I'm kind of lethargic, I need another cup of coffee. So I understand completely. Now, I have to take something she just said and explain to everybody. This lady is a world-class athlete, has been for over 25 years. So when she says 45 minutes with the weights plus an hour on the bike, don't go, oh man, I can't do all that. You don't have to do all that. That's what she does because that's who she is and what she's done her entire life. You don't need to do that much, but you do need to do something.
Oh my goodness, what you could do just with half an hour is amazing. A half an hour could start most people's bodies, metabolisms, get that runner's high in the gym. It's amazing. You don't have to work nearly as hard as I do. That is for sure.
Let's talk about your nutrition. What do you eat? How do you eat? Do you still have restrictions in your diet? What's a normal day's food intake?
Oh my goodness. I never had restrictions. Well, that's why I love to train. That's why I love my sports, because I love food. I'm a foodie. I certainly eat healthy and I eat well and I don't do junk food and things like that, but I love my food. And the best way to keep the weight off the hips or any other place in my body, where when I was younger or even today, it's by certainly by keeping active and working out. But basically, I when I ate meat, and I don't eat meat anymore, but when I ate meat, it was lean meat, skinless chicken, tons of vegetables, seeds, nuts, grains, organic foods, try and stay away from the genetically modified stuff. I normally did not eat after 8 in the evening. I snacked between, but then I had to because I was training a lot. Now that I'm not training and working out as much as 40 hours a week, I normally eat 3 meals a day. I usually eat my biggest meal usually is lunch hour. My lunch, my dinner is usually a lighter meal and always a nice healthy breakfast and about an hour before any type of physical activity.
See, she said one thing there that's important. Americans are notorious for skipping breakfast, and that's the biggest mistake in the world. You really need to have something in your body. You need that fuel.
We're damaging our bodies incredibly by not having that breakfast. We want to drive a car with no gasoline in it. And although we are not made out of mechanical parts like cars are, we have something called volition and will, which will make us go even though we don't have any gas in our tank. But we are causing irreparable damage to our pancreas, to our levels of sugar, to our metabolic rates, to our blood pressure, to our heart. We're causing so much stress to our system because we're expecting it to work and to work hard under very difficult circumstances without the appropriate fuel, nutrition, minerals, vitamins, liquids that it requires to keep us healthy and moving forward and living for a long time.
And one thing about that a lot of people will use the rationale, well, if I skip a meal, it's less calories, I'm going to lose some weight. Your body does the same thing that we do. If you have a big steak in front of you, do you eat the fat first? Do you eat the gristle first? You eat the good meat. You eat the muscle. And your body does the same thing. If it's going to burn calories and you're not getting enough nutrition, it's not going to burn off the extra fat. It's going to burn off the quality muscle. You have to get adequate nutrition.
It is so true.
End of lecture.
No, it's very, very true. And I've spoken to many, many women in the gym who come up to me and say, "Oh, you look so good," and this and that. And, you know, I've been, you know, on this bike for 6 months, or I've been trying to do this for 8 months, and I just can't seem to get anywhere. How do you do it? And my first thing I ask them, first of all, you know, like, what are you doing? And what you're spending all your time on the bike? Are you doing any weights? If you are you doing any more than 10 pound weights? And oh, by the way, have you eaten before you came? And before you know it, they haven't eaten. They've spent most of their time on a Stairmaster or on a bike. And when they do lift weights, they don't lift any heavier than 8 pounds because they're afraid that they're going to get big and muscular. My next question is then, well, excuse me, why are you at the gym? Oh, well, I need to lose weight. So can I assume that you consider yourself overweight or fat? And they go, well, yeah. Well, my next question is, well, do you think that that big thigh that you're trying to make slimmer would look better if it was firm and toned and muscular than in its present shape? And always the answer was, well, of course. And my normal response is, well, did you know that fat actually takes up more space than muscle? And so by growing muscle and by lifting weights and getting a proper nutrition, you'll actually get smaller than bigger. And ultimately, I fit better in my clothes when I am lifting weights. I wear a smaller size when I'm lifting weights. When I'm ill and I've had surgeries on my eyes and I have to abstain from weightlifting and any training, I normally go up one dress size. When I go back to weightlifting and I go back to training, eating the same as I was, I drop a dress size within 6 to 8 weeks.
Well, can't argue with those kind of results. You and I can talk for very long periods of time. Unfortunately, people don't want to listen for very, very long periods of time. So we're going to get away from all the nutrition and the exercise. And I want to talk briefly about your, what would be the right word? I guess political activities, being a part of the IOC and the Paralympic Committee, and how all of that came about in kind of the Reader's Digest version of it. Because this lady is not just an amazing athlete. She is an amazing lady, and she's accomplished so much for so many people.
Thank you. Well, one of the reasons I corrected you on the word Paralympic is because I represented that movement for nearly 30 years. And what I mean by representing is that I was the first athletes representative elected in Canada to the Canadian Paralympic Committee, which meant that I was to take the athletes' woes and concerns and complaints to the governing body that governed the Canadian national team and brought them to Paralympic Games and World Championships. I was learning how to be diplomatic and political, but not fast enough. And I stepped on many toes, so forth and so on. But one thing I did do is I was very successful and I got the complaints taken care of. And the athletes were happy with the work that I did and continued to reelect me term after term, even though maybe the politicals and the administrators were not so happy about that. The athletes continued to represent me, to elect me. And as their representative, I began to rise in the ranks from the provincial organization to the national organization. I was nominated to the international organization, which is the International Paralympic Committee, the IPC. There, I was elected by my peers, which are the 5,000 Paralympic summer athletes that compete at the Paralympic Games. I was elected to the IPC Athletes Council. I was one of 9 members. Within a year and a half, I ran for the position of chair and subsequently became the first woman and first blind chair of the International Paralympic Athletes Committee. By virtue of becoming the chair of the IPC Athletes Committee, I began to represent all Paralympic winter and summer athletes in the world, which number about 8,000. I also became a member of the IPC Executive Committee, which is the decision-making body for the entire Paralympic movement. Soon after that, I was nominated to and appointed to the International Olympic Committee Athletes Committee and began to be the first Paralympic and blind and female representative to the IOC as a Paralympic athlete from the IPC and the IPC Athletes Council. And these two bodies, international bodies, gave me an incredible opportunity to see sport being organized at the international level, from the political level, from the financial aspects, as well as in international diplomacy. It was an incredible time that I spent during my mandate, two mandates as the chair, and had a fantastic time. In the meantime, I'm also a motivational speaker, and while I was traveling around the world for International Olympic Committee or International Paralympic Committee meetings or games, I was also going to the odd presentation for a corporation or organization. And so both of my worlds collided that way in the most harmonious way. And so what can I say? Everything that I have done in the last 30 years of my life has had, one way or another, something incredibly integral to do with the Paralympic movement, which truly impacted and changed the direction of my life in the most profound manner. I was a little girl many, many years ago watching a television screen, watching incredible athletes doing whatever it is that they do best on the athletic field. But it was the advent of the Paralympics into my life that changed my dreams into reality. By no shortage of perseverance and tenacity and commitment and hard work on my part, certainly, and support by many of that same dream. The Paralympic movement is what gave my dreams wings to fly and take flight. And for that, I will forever be grateful. And for that reason, I gave the next 20 years of my life in my time, in my passion, and in my talent, not in the athletic field, but in the boardrooms, in trying to change the future of those athletes coming after me with similar dreams. I wanted whatever barriers I faced never to happen to them, and for them to find that the Paralympic movement could affect their lives from a much younger age than it managed to catch me.
Okay. You know, a lot of people call themselves motivational speakers, but this woman, if you listen to her story, if you look at her website, and you're not inspired to do more by looking at her story, listening to her story, there's something very wrong with you. We need to wrap this up, and I'd like to know if you could just offer me a quick final thought.
A quick final thought. Oh my goodness.
I know quick is not in your vocabulary, I know.
That's a long word, you know. Quick final thought. Mm-hmm. I think the quick final thought that I want to leave your listeners with are three words: choice, commitment, and courage. Every one of you have the ability to make a choice, to make a difference in your life and in the lives of others. Every one of you, I'm going to challenge to try and commit to making a difference in your health, in your future, and especially if you're blind and visually impaired, to make sure that you look after your health in the easiest way possible. Take care of your health by becoming active, doing something that you love. And then I'm going to further challenge you to find the courage within to identify that which turns your crank and makes you happy and finds that runner's wall, that euphoria, whether it be in the gym or on the track or on the ski slopes. Go out there and live your life to its fullest and help your heart and the rest of you live that life along with you in a healthy and long way.
Very well said. We're going to wrap this up. You've been listening to a truly amazing lady. Look in the show notes for the web address to her site, and we're going to list all of her accomplishments and all of the honors in her site, because if we go through that on here, it's going to take up another half an hour at least, because she's got more awards. I would say she is probably the most honored and decorated female athlete, maybe one in the entire world. Not disabled or Paralympic athlete, just most decorated female athlete. Just the list is amazing. You've been listening to Real World Fitness. Now, next week, my guest is going to be Laurel Blackburn, who is a senior RKC kettlebell instructor and the owner of a boot camp and a gym here in Florida. And she was instrumental in getting me through my kettlebell certification. And we're going to talk with her next week about some of the projects she's done and about how she got to beat me up all day a few months ago. And this is Bill with Real World Fitness. We'll see you next week. Real World Fitness is a production of the Serotalk Podcast Network in cooperation with CosiabaFitness.com. All questions, comments, and feedback should be submitted to resources@serotalk.com. If you're listening on a mobile device, use your iBlink radio app to submit an iReport. Promotional consideration paid for by Audible.com.